Case number 23-5044, in re sealed case. Mr. Holzblatt for the appellant, Mr. Pierce for the appellee.
Good morning. I just wanted to thank you all for briefing this appeal so quickly and for being here this morning. We know that each side sees the stakes as highly significant, and as ever, we're grateful for counsel's assistance to fully understand your positions before we decide the issues before us. So, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ari Holzblatt for appellant. I'm asked to reserve 4 minutes if possible. There are three issues on appeal. I'd like to give the court our bottom line position on each of them before returning to the first issue. On issue one, the First Amendment requires vacater of the non-disclosure order. Strict scrutiny required the government to prove that disclosing this warrant would concretely harm the government's investigation, and the government failed to do so, largely because the public already knows not only who and what are being investigated, but also the fact that the government is collecting the former president's electronic communications. On issue two, the First Amendment separately require the district court to resolve Twitter's challenge to the NDO before ordering production under the warrant. That's because Twitter's challenge to the NDO could have been resolved with minimal delay, and because the NDO blocked protected speech whose value would be irretrievably diminished upon production, namely speech that would enable the former president to elect to assert a colorable constitutional privilege against production before that privilege was infringed. Now, finally, on issue three, the district court abused its discretion by imposing any contempt sanction at all, much less the unprecedented $350,000 sanction, when Twitter indisputably had substantially complied with the warrant by the court's deadline and indisputably worked around the clock to complete production of non-standard data, a mere 4 hours after the government finally clarified the scope of the document request. Now, returning to issue one, these investigations are unusually public. The Attorney General of the United States announced the investigations at a press conference. The government has served dozens of subpoenas and warrants on Mr. Trump's closest confidants without any equivalent non-disclosure order.
Mr. Holzblatt, it seems to me that your argument on this point is greatly hindered by the fact that you don't know what the district court relied upon in issuing this order.
That's correct, Your Honor. We don't know the specific facts that were relied upon.
As she said, you don't know what you don't know. So how can you be making these arguments without understanding what the court relied on? You're saying she erred without knowing what she relied on.
There are two things we do know, Your Honor. The first is we know what is public. And so what we know is that...
And if I disagree with you that that's sufficient to challenge that, what else have you got?
What we know is how the district court described the nature of the interests that were at issue in the area surrounding the ex parte submission. And we know what the First Amendment requires. The First Amendment requires searching, not deferential review. Here, the district court said it was deferring. That suggests to us that the district court did not have the kind of concrete and specific evidence that was particular to this warrant of additional harm.
So you suspect that she did not, but you don't know that.
Well, that's, Your Honor, that's obviously the nature of these proceedings, that we have to point to what we do know. We know that the NDO, as it was originally obtained, included a rationale that the district court and the government admitted was erroneous. We know all of the information that's public. We know that the government has already sought, through dozens of warrants, electronic communications with the president. We know that the government has sought communications from the former vice president.
It's just that none of that goes to what was specifically before the district court in this case, and knowledge about the specific investigative measures they were taking are not public.
Of course, Your Honor, we don't know specifically what's in the warrant. What it appears, and again, we acknowledge, what we know is what appears from the district court's opinion And
so if that's not sufficient, you lose, correct?
We are dependent on the First Amendment.
I understand what you're depending on, but if that's not sufficient to sustain what you're trying to do here, you lose. If knowledge of what's in the public record is insufficient to prove that what the district court in fact relied upon, which is not public, was sufficient to support what she did, then you lose.
Well, it's not our burden to prove that strict scrutiny wasn't satisfied. It's the government's burden to prove that strict scrutiny is satisfied. And so if what is in the ex parte record established that there was some additional harm that would be caused by disclosure of this warrant, if, for example,
then you would lose.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Why don't you move on to your next argument?
Well, actually, I was going to ask, just sort of getting at the same point. Assuming hypothetically that you have a subscriber and there's probable cause to believe that your subscriber committed a crime to support a warrant, and assuming that there's evidence to show, you know, I mean, this is just a hypothetical, that your subscriber had been served with a warrant with respect to a different electronic communications provider and had responded to that with, you know, efforts to manipulate witnesses, let's say. And then the government seeks a non-disclosure order in serving a warrant on your client with respect to your service you provide. Would that suffice to support the non-disclosure order, or actually would that suffice to provide the compelling governmental interest that you require in order to have the prior restraint on your speech be legitimate?
It would move in the right direction, Your Honor. I think there are two additional questions that would need to be answered. The first is, at the time that the government filed its opposition to Twitter's motion to vacate the non-disclosure order, it had the contents of the Twitter account. So the factual record that the government put in to the district court was not just based on what it had at the time that it applied for the NDO, but to defend maintaining the NDO, it had the contents of the account. And at that moment, it had available to it information about, are there witnesses, are there correspondents that disclosure of the warrant would reveal who might be intimidated? Is there a category of evidence that might be revealed by the actual contents of this warrant? I agree, Judge Pan, I don't know what is in the record.
But do you have the opportunity to challenge that at a later date? What's in the warrant?
We don't. This is the only opportunity that Twitter has to vindicate its speech right, which is to speak when it matters most, which is in time to be able to enable its user to speak. And if what Your Honor is referring to is whether Mr. Trump has an opportunity to later challenge infringement on his privilege, I want to distinguish between two ways that courts have historically dealt with infringement on a user's or an individual's interest in the context of a warrant. Where there's a Fourth Amendment interest, traditionally, there's a post hoc suppression opportunity. When it comes to a privilege, courts, and we've cited cases from the 11th, the 4th, and the Third Circuit that have all recognized this, courts have historically allowed there to be litigation over to stop the government's review of documents that potentially implicate the privilege at this moment in time.
So you don't have standing, though, to protect any privilege interest that the account holder has, and you concede that.
We don't have standing to protect the account holder. We have.
But the timing of this only goes to the account holder's ability to assert a privilege claim. So with respect to your client's interests, it's just to disclose. But the timing is an interest that belongs to the account holder, not Twitter.
I don't agree, Your Honor. And let me explain why.
Okay.
So the Fourth Circuit case that we cited involved an attorney who, and obviously, as you know, the attorney-client privilege is a privilege held by the client, not by the attorney. The Fourth Circuit case that we cited was an attorney that, at this moment in time, was able to challenge documents that have been seized from the attorney's office in order to protect the attorney-client privilege that was held by the client. Similarly, we cited a case from the Third Circuit where a doctor was allowed to submit to challenge at this stage of the proceeding the interests of disclosure of patient records. So it is not at all unusual for where documents have been seized from an individual and they implicate the privilege or interest of a third party, for the individual who is in Twitter's position to be able to intervene at that moment to protect third parties' interests. Now, the second.
No, wait, Mr. Holzblatt, are you arguing that the potential existence of an executive privilege in this case, however unsettled that may be, affects the First Amendment analysis because it's especially important to providers of electronic communication services to be able to notify users if there are any confidentiality breaches that affect interests that a user would think are very important? Like I'm trying to get, because as I think it's established that you don't have standing to challenge the NDO and whether it complies with the Act, I'm trying to appreciate how and where it does fit into your, or that you argue it fits into your First Amendment.
Thank you, Your Honor. The First Amendment, and I think this is the second point that I wanted to make to Japan, the First Amendment doesn't just protect the right to speak. It protects the right to speak when it matters most. And so the timing of speech matters. And this was established by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Friedman decision, the canonical prior restraint decision, where the court held that where there's a prior restraint, the right to speak is the right to speak promptly. And promptly is determined by context. Where the reason that the restrained individual is seeking to speak is in order to protect a third party's interest.
And so you're arguing, I mean, Friedman is quite a different context, but I take it that you're really relying on Friedman to support your argument that the review of the non-disclosure order should have traveled with the production of with the review of the warrant.
That is one way that we're using Friedman. Yes, sir.
And the other way you're using it is?
The second way we're using it is that the Friedman requires there be an adversary judicial proceeding to challenge the actual grounds on which the government relied in obtaining a prior restraint. And so the government here has, I believe, taken the position that it can obtain a non-disclosure order on one ground, and then that ground is shaped by the statute that authorizes it, but then it doesn't have to rely on those statutory grounds or even the grounds that it relied on in obtaining the non-disclosure order when it defends the non-disclosure order in the adversary judicial proceeding. I don't think that can be squared with Friedman.
When the district judge passed on the non-disclosure order, she had nor did the government have the fruits of the warrant, did they?
Yes, they did.
How so? The warrant hadn't been.
I'm sorry.
There's no warrant return yet.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was, when you said passed, I wasn't sure what you meant by passed. When the district court
ruled.
When the district court initially obtained the non-disclosure order, they did not. When the district court address our Friedman rights for an adversary judicial proceeding, yes, but the government and the court had the benefits of the returns because we had produced at that point. And so the timing of the proceeding was that the non-disclosure order was initially obtained before the warrant was served on Twitter. Twitter then, as your honors know, challenged the non-disclosure order, and there was a proceeding, and Twitter asked for the two to be adjudicated together. The district court denied Twitter's request to adjudicate them together and held Twitter in contempt. Twitter then produced the contents of the account. Over our objection, the government filed its brief 2 weeks later, responding to our motion to vacate the non-disclosure order. In other words, after Twitter had produced on the warrant.
And your supposition is that the government may have, in defending the non-disclosure order, with some, what I take it you would claim, circularity, they've used the results of that to justify it?
I don't know if they have.
But is that your suggestion?
No, the opposite, Your Honor. My suggestion is if they fail to use the results of the warrant, then that would undermine any claim that they've satisfied strict scrutiny. In other words, at the moment in time when the government defended in the adversary proceeding, whether they could satisfy strict scrutiny, they could inform the court.
I think I'm agreeing with you that at the time that the non-disclosure order is approved, the district judge had a certain amount of information before her, some of it ex parte. And I think you're arguing that whatever was before her then is what's relevant for purposes of whether the government's interest in the integrity of its investigation survives strict scrutiny.
I want to be clear. I want to make sure I understand which point in time Your Honor is asking about.
When she first allowed them to proceed and obtain the information the warrant sought.
I think
when she allowed that to go ahead without having separately decided your First Amendment challenge, at that time, the information that was before her that she decided, so she was allowing them to go forward in confidence.
I think the answer is both.
With a gag rule on you. She was allowing the gag rule to be in place. And I think you're saying whatever she had then is the basis on which the compelling interest must rest.
I'm actually saying something slightly different.
Okay.
I'm saying both. The government had to satisfy strict scrutiny at the outset, and it had to satisfy strict scrutiny to maintain the non-disclosure order later. When the government first obtained, so the question before the court, the district court, should have been, is there enough to get this non-disclosure order from the outset, from the very moment when we obtain it? Once the adversarial proceeding had unfolded, at that moment in time, the government actually had the returns from the warrant. And in my exchange with Judge Pan earlier, we were talking about whether there is an additional harm that is specific to this warrant that would be revealed. And I think, Judge Pillard, you asked a hypothetical question about, well, what if there is a track record of service on a particular provider, and in response to the knowledge of that service, the target, the account holder had taken steps to intimidate the correspondent. I think the question then would be, are there new witnesses in the returns that actually support that theory? And did the government identify those new witnesses and say to the court in its ex parte submission, here are the witnesses we are worried about this user intimidating because of this track record, and we're going to link that information to, we're going to identify that as an additional harm concretely, and show that that's different than all of the information that's already out there.
So I take you to be arguing today something that I did not see in the briefing, which is that there are two questions. One is, was the non-disclosure order justified restraint, prior restraint on speech, when it was first put in place? And was it a justified prior restraint on speech as of the time when the government learned what the results of the warrant contained? And I don't take you to, did you ever ask the district judge once the information had been turned over, like, in light of that, can we lift the non-disclosure order? Because I think you're right that its validity has to be judged from the time the non-disclosure obligation is first placed on your client. That seems right to me. And that we were looking at that time and we're reviewing with reference to that time. That's the basic question. And I take you to be raising a separate question, which is, of course, you know, the speech restraint continues and it continues to restrict your speech. And so is there a changed circumstance that should require revisiting?
So we did not disaggregate the two moments in time in our briefing before the district court. What we said was in an active, the non-disclosure order should be lifted. So the relief that we were seeking in the district court was not retrospective relief. We weren't saying we needed some kind of backward-looking relief. What we were arguing to the district court is, here's the information we have. We acknowledge we're not fighting the notion that we're at a disadvantage. We have less information, but we have a lot of information about what is already in the public sphere. And there is...
So I'm just confused about this, because the compelling interest that's being asserted is the secrecy and integrity of the investigation. Did that change somehow after you revealed the account information?
Well, Your Honor, I wanted to break apart my answer in two parts. The compelling interest is not secrecy and integrity investigation. Secrecy is a circular justification for any non-disclosure order by definition.
Jeopardizes the investigation, that's in the catch-all of the statute. So the district court issues a non-disclosure order. One of the bases of that is the catch-all provision of the statute jeopardizing the investigation. And revealing your investigative steps to the target is a well-known and acknowledged risk to the investigative process. So if that's the interest, has that changed after you've, issued the return on the warrant? I don't think it has.
I agree that serious jeopardy, which is, I think, actually quite a high standard, serious jeopardy, not sort of some, in some vague sense, integrity of the investigation, is a compelling interest. Whether or not the government can satisfy that interest depends on the information, and the government bears the burden. It depends on the set of information the government has available to it. Once the government has the returns, if what the government in this incredibly unusual case, where so much is public about this investigation, if the particular concern about disclosure of this warrant that the government is identifying is a concern that there's some witness that is going to be intimidated, for example, that is different than...
So are you just saying that the court needs to reevaluate after it gets the return information and make sure that it's still compelling?
Well, what I'm saying is the government bears the burden at the time it filed its brief to submit evidence that actually establishes an additional harm compared to all that's already public.
But and if it had done that at the beginning, that would suffice.
It would suffice at the beginning. It would not suffice...
Unless something in the return alleviated the concern.
To the extent what the government was relying on at the beginning was a predictive judgment, if that judgment wasn't borne out by what they obtained in the return and they didn't address that, then that would be telling.
I hear you. That's really helpful.
And when we're looking at the compelling government interest, are we only speaking to the secrecy and integrity of the investigation, or should there also be the district court be allowed to have concerns about obstruction and spoliation of evidence?
I think the three compelling interests that are available to the government here are destruction of evidence or spoliation of evidence, intimidation of witnesses, or serious jeopardy the investigation, because those are the three statutory harms that the government identified when it obtained the non-disclosure order. I don't think that secrecy in by itself is a compelling government interest that can justify the order, and integrity. If what integrity means is destruction of evidence and intimidation of witnesses or serious jeopardy investigation, then it isn't adding anything to what is in the statute. If it means something different than what is in the statute, then no, I don't think that can justify.
And then as to your general comment about the public has knowledge of a broader investigation, balance that for me against what the district judge would have known potentially in the ex parte investigation. With the documents coming to her ex parte, and this is kind of piggybacking on Judge Pan's earlier discussions with you about what the district court knew at that time, which you would not know because it was ex parte. So in other words, I'm asking, you might have a broader knowledge about the public investigation. You know, the public would know generally that, but the district court has something different in front of them. And how are we to opine or question that there's something perhaps more serious in whatever is in front of her?
So, Your Honor, I think we actually know quite a bit in the public sphere. We know that the government is specifically seeking electronic communications with the president. That's public. And we know that there are dozens of subpoenas and warrants that have been served on the closest confidants of the president for communications with the president, the vice president, the president's lawyers, daughter, son-in-law. And so the question the question needs to be evaluated by the evidence that's in the ex parte record and that's in the public record. And the searching inquiry that strict scrutiny requires is there an additional harm when we take as a baseline all that is already known, not just the target and subject of the investigation, but also that the government is already seeking electronic communications, that the government is publicly known to be seeking communications with lawyers, everyone at Mar-a-Lago, the vice president, the former chief of staff, daughter, son-in-law, with all of that information, is there some additional harm, concrete additional harm that is identified here?
Mr. Holzwell, sorry to interrupt you.
No.
Just to clarify, had they requested from your client any account information analogous to what is being sought here, for example, with the president's daughter, did they come to you and say, we want this her as subscriber, or we want the kind of information that they've sought?
If what Your Honor is asking is whether Twitter has been received a warrant for the president's daughter.
With respect to any other user in the circle you described.
I don't know.
Let me go back. You have your less restrictive alternatives.
That's right.
That you were proposing. You emphasize what you see as a colorable executive privilege claim, and you say, well, look, there are other ways to protect that other than the non-disclosure order. How about identifying one of the former president's representatives? And the government responds, well, that really puts the court in a pretty untenable line drawing position. And they say, that we would have to examine the group of lawyers and advisors of the former president and determine who's sufficiently trustworthy to not disclose and jeopardize the investigation. Is that not a problem in your view?
It's not a problem for two reasons, Your Honor. The first is that the government itself, in its briefing to this court, said some of these individuals are not trustworthy for this particular reason we've identified it. That concedes that some don't have this objection. Strict scrutiny places the burden on the government to show that no less restrictive alternative exists. Here we have an obvious less restrictive alternative, which is to permit disclosure to a representative who has been designated.
What would be the point of that if the point is to allow the assertion of the executive privilege? They would have to tell the account holder.
They would not necessarily have to tell the account holder. This is one.
It can be asserted by other people other than the account holder?
It may or may not be able to, but they certainly are in a position to assert more rights on the president's behalf, former president's behalf, than Twitter is. And in fact, the Presidential Records Act and the regulations implementing the Presidential Records Act specifically speak of providing notice before disclosure of presidential records, either the president or his representative. And so this process of which the Supreme Court relied on in Nixon versus GSA as one of the necessary safeguards.
But isn't the whole point of it being revealed to a representative that representative represents the account holder and they're going to tell the account holder? They can't assert the rights of the account holder without telling the account holder.
They, they can represent the, they can do a number of things to represent the interests of the account holder. That may be to challenge their ability to speak to the account holder in ways that Twitter is not in a position to do.
And if that's not practical though, then you have no other alternative and there would be no other way to narrowly tailor this.
I guess I'm not sure what it means that it's not practical. I think that
if there is a finding by the district court that I don't know who's trustworthy, who's not, I don't know whether that representative is going to tell the account holder, and the whole point of the compelling government interest is to protect the integrity of the investigation, because if this gets to the account holder, it could affect the statutory factors. Then there's no way to narrowly tailor this.
No, Your Honor, because the there is a way to prevent the representatives from speaking to the account holder, which is to extend the non-disclosure order to the representatives, and the district court ignored.
But why is that any better than extending it to you? Because the account holder still can't assert executive privilege without knowing about this.
Because in this incredibly unusual circumstance, where in Nixon versus GSA, the Supreme Court identified the ability that cited to these regulations in the Presidential Records Act and identified the ability to inform representatives of the president. Right. This is a circumstance.
That's fine, where this is factually speaking, the judge here said it's untenable. I don't know who the would be trustworthy, and I don't know that they're not going to tell the account holder. Short of that, then there's no other way to narrowly tailor this.
Well, there's two errors in that conclusion, Your Honor.
But am I correct that if that's correct, then there's no other way to narrowly tailor? You've got nothing but either reveal part of this to the account holder or reveal part of this or all of this to his representatives. And if neither of those options is sufficient to safeguard the compelling interest of preserving the investigation and its integrity, then strict scrutiny is satisfied.
Well, Your Honor, I think I have to take the district court's opinion as it's written. So with the district court opinion as it's written committed two errors on this point. The first is that the district court put the burden on Twitter, not on the government, to satisfy narrow tailoring. Saying I can't tell who's trustworthy puts the burden on Twitter. It doesn't put the burden on the government to establish that they are not trustworthy. That's the first problem. The second problem is
I think we're looking just for the universe of possibilities, be that from the government or from Twitter, and there doesn't seem to be any way to I guess, achieve the compelling government interest of maintaining integrity and secrecy.
I don't agree, Your Honor. And the second reason is that what Your Honor just asked is, what if these representatives would tell the president? There is a tool available to prevent that. And so if the government's concern about why this alternative is not equally effective at achieving the government's interest, then that tool needs to be used to solve
it. You mean a non-disclosure order to the representative?
That's correct.
But why can't there be a non-disclosure order to you? Because the whole point of this is, in your view, is to allow the account holder to assert executive privilege if he wishes to do so. He can't do that if nobody tells him. So what good is it to tell his representatives?
Well, I want to actually refine this point about speech interest here. It is this dispute is occurring in the context of a privilege, which is a constitutional privilege, which the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld intrusion on only when there are certain safeguards present. So that's an important context. But when it comes to Twitter's speech interest, the first issue on appeal, not the second issue, when it comes to the first issue on appeal, the less restrictive alternative is independent of that presidential privilege question. The only question that has to be asked is there a less restrictive alternative that would restrict Twitter speech less, but still be equally effective at achieving the government's interest?
Disclosing, that's the equally effective part. That's why I think that you're not able to propose something that's equally effective.
If the only harm that the district court or the government has identified of disclosing the representative is that the representative may then turn around and tell the president, then that harm is fully addressed by extending the non-disclosure order to that representative. And that allows Twitter to speak more. It is less restrictive, and it is equally effective at addressing the government's harm.
Okay, and I take you just then to have argued that it's less restrictive on Twitter to be able to tell a trusted representative, even a representative who would be under non-disclosure order of the court, even if that representative were not legally in any position to assert executive privilege without the former president's knowledge and approval.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you did argue in your reply brief that there is some authorization under basically the president's Presidential Records Act authorization, but you're not arguing that that authorization of certain persons to act in his stead for the protection and disposition of the presidential records of his presidency, you're not arguing that that actually authorizes those named individuals to assert executive privilege.
So I don't know the answer to that. We're not making that argument because I don't know the answer to it, but I think it's premature actually to resolve it. I think it's important in this incredibly sensitive context that we move one step at a time, that we have a system, the Presidential Records Act, which has been reviewed by the Supreme Court for its constitutionality, that understands that there are incredibly sensitive concerns that are implicated here, and that is specifically identified the ability to empower a representative to represent the president's interests and to have notice of a potential intrusion on presidential records as part of the process. And there may well be steps that that representative can take short of asserting executive privilege to advocate on behalf of those interests, even when they are subject to the non-disclosure order. And I think that given that that was available as a less restrictive alternative, given that it could be done without intruding on the government's concerns, and given that the incredibly unusual context that we're operating in, we should have moved the ball forward, even if it only moves the ball forward a little bit. It moves the ball forward in a way that is respectful of Twitter's very significant First Amendment interests and is respectful of the underlying context that is so sensitive in this case.
Let me ask you about the, unless my colleagues have further questions than that, I wanted to turn before we let you sit down to the sanction question.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. It seems to me, Mr. Holzblatt, that Twitter's entire position in this case seems to overlook the significance that these are orders of a federal judge. She's made a finding of probable cause. She's applied statutory factors. It's the court's job to think about the executive privilege of the target, of the account holder. But Twitter has taken upon itself to do things like review the NDO for its facial validity. That was quite striking to me. I thought that was our job to review warrants and court orders, not Twitter's job. Twitter's taken upon itself to try to protect the account holder's right to assert executive privilege. But what you're overlooking is there is a district court judge, a federal judge, who has considered all of these factors and issued orders. You don't even know what she relied upon, but you seem to be trying to take over the role of the federal judge in this case. And I'd like you to respond to that, because it's really quite extraordinary to me to see what Twitter is trying to do in this case.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to respond to that. In Friedman, the Supreme Court held that a prior restraint, which is what we have here, cannot be upheld unless there is an opportunity for a prompt adversarial judicial
process. It didn't say adversarial. It's a judicial process. And you've got a judicial process here. You've got a judge who's made a finding of probable cause and issued an order and has applied statutory factors and issued an order. You've got your judicial process right here. And I think it's the Second Circuit that said this is the highest form of process you get. This is a criminal proceeding. You've got a judge who looked at this and applied factors and held that it was fine. And the judge has an obligation to consider the effect on the account holder and privilege, and she might have done so without you knowing it. There might be things in place, tape teams and things of that nature in place to address these types of issues, but you don't know.
Respectfully, Your Honor, Friedman held there has to be an adversarial.
It also said in a non-criminal setting, did it not?
I am unaware of a single court, even in national security letter context, Second Circuit in Doe versus Mukasey, the Ninth Circuit in Twitter versus Garland, which were both national security letter cases, they held that even if Freedman doesn't apply, at a minimum, there has to be an adversarial proceeding where the party who is whose speech is restrained has the opportunity to challenge the specific grounds. So
I'd like to know where it specifically says adversarial. I mean, I read Freedman. It talks about the non-criminal context. It addresses a census system to where a film would be reviewed by a census body. And it said, we need to get to a judicial process promptly. And there is a judicial process here already. And I feel that Twitter is just overlooking the fact that, that a judge has looked at this and has applied both the law under the Constitution and the statute and has made holdings. And you don't even know what she relied upon, but you come in and try to usurp her role.
Thank you. I don't have the pin cited Freedman that uses the word adversarial. I will get it for you. Okay. However,
and it does say non-criminal.
I can't imagine a circumstance more significant than national security letters. And both in the NRA national security letter case from the Ninth Circuit, Twitter versus Garland and Doe versus McKay,
which all held that Freedman wasn't applicable.
What they held was that
they said those are censorship and licensing contexts, which is not really applicable here.
At 7:02 in Twitter versus Garland, what the court held was that there were, quote, robust, speaking to Freedman, it said we don't need to apply these specific procedures in Freedman because there are procedures which are, quote, robust and which resemble the Freedman requirements in key respects. And then when it actually spoke of the specific procedures, and there's whole sections of both the Ninth Circuit decision and the Second Circuit decision when it's actually addressing what makes the statutory scheme constitutional in those cases. And one of the things that it identifies is specifically is the ability of the entity whose speech is restrained to challenge the particular grounds on which the restraint was obtained.
You can raise a First Amendment issue, which you have. You've had that process. You've been permitted to. But the statute, in terms of the NDO itself, and the warrant, this whole process, the statute limits you to challenging whether the production would be voluminous or burdensome. And you can really raise your First Amendment issue, which you have.
That's right, Your Honor. We have. And if the statute somehow precluded us from doing what we've done here.
You can raise your First Amendment issue, but the manner in which you've done so, you reviewed the NDO for facial validity, or your general counsel did. And that is not the role of Twitter.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, that is what every one of the courts that I just cited held is necessary when there's a prior restraint.
Really? Wait. I'm sorry, Judge Pillard. You're saying that there is support and precedent that allows the recipient of a warrant to assess its facial validity before complying?
I'm sorry. Assess the warrant's facial validity or the NDO's facial validity?
Either of them. They're both court orders.
Yes, Your Honor.
There's a process for challenging the facial validity of a court order, and that's filing something in court. But what Twitter did was it said, I think this is facially invalid, so I won't comply until you address my concerns about this other order that was issued.
Well, so I want to pull apart what I understand your honor to be challenging. When Twitter challenged the order of the court whose facial validity Twitter challenged was the NDO.
Yes.
The NDO is the restriction on Twitter speech. And every one of the courts I said, I'm unaware of a single court in the country ever to have held.
But I'm focusing on you conditioned your compliance with the warrant, which you do not dispute validity of, on addressing your concerns about speech.
Thank you, Ron.
And how is that okay?
So what Twitter did in this circumstance is actually not very novel. It's consistent with the case from the Fourth Circuit, the Third Circuit, the 11th Circuit, that Twitter cited, each of which held that where a warrant potentially infringes on the privilege of a party, including where a warrant may infringe on a privilege interest, not of the recipient or where the warrant has been served, but on a third party, that it is appropriate for, with respect to the infringement on privilege, to go to court and to challenge whether or not the search and review of those documents should be.
That's fine, but you conditioned your compliance with the warrant, which is a completely separate order that you don't challenge, and you delayed and conditioned your compliance with the warrant until your concerns with the NDO were resolved.
Which is exactly analogous to everything that happened in those cases, with one exception, and which I want to address, Your Honor. It sounds like Your Honor's concern is that Twitter talked to the government before it went to court. And what I actually think,
complete what you were saying. That wasn't what I was trying to say, but I want to understand what you perceived me to be saying.
I think it has always been my practice, Your Honor. I think it's Twitter's practice. If they have a dispute with the government or with anyone, to try to work out that dispute informally before going to court. What Twitter did in this circumstance is it reached out to the government, or it spoke to the government, and it said, these are our concerns, and these are the ways in which the warrant and the NDO intersect, and where and how compliance with the warrant actually infringes on and intrudes on the speech interest that Twitter has here. We would like to identify that concern for you and see if we can work this out. There was then a dialogue which ensued. The government said, why don't you get back to me? We'll talk on January 31st, which was after the deadline on the warrant. And in that conversation, the government said, you have authority for your position. Why don't you give it to me tomorrow? And so Twitter came back on February 1st, again, after the deadline on the warrant, and said, here's our perspective. This is why we think these issues are linked. And then on February 2nd, continued the conversation, at which point the government said, we're going to court. And Twitter said, okay, we're going to go to court too, and we'll resolve this. We've clearly not been able to work out our disagreements. Twitter had a bona fide, and still has, and is asserting in this court, a bona fide First Amendment interest in not only being able to speak, but in the timing of its speech. And that timing of its speech was impacted by being able to produce on the warrant. What Twitter did in this case was it attempted to work things out informally and directly with the government before it litigated. And to the extent the concern of the court or the court below was that Twitter tried to resolve this dispute informally before it went to court, I don't think that should be a basis of concern. And to the extent
I think the concern is the manner in which Twitter did so, saying that we're going to condition our compliance with warrant on the addressing of our concerns with the NDO. But I understand your position. I'm sorry, Judge Pillard, go ahead.
So I just focusing again on this Friedman point and your emphasis that in Friedman there was a reference to requiring not just efficient process to end the prior restraint as quickly as possible, but that it be adversarial. I take the role of that in support of your First Amendment argument that it's important, the court found it important to avoid making the censor's determinations final in practice. And that your concern applying that here is that it really goes to sort of the level of generality and what the court is requiring of the government when it allows a non-disclosure order to govern. And so in particular, if the government can come in and say, we think this investigation would be jeopardized if there isn't a non-disclosure order, that's a compelling interest, so please, judge, put a non-disclosure order in place, that raises the concern, you know, when stated at that level of generality, you know, if the courts are rubber stamping that kind of presentation, that raises a distinct context, but that raises in your mind a concern analogous to the concern, particularly by the court of Freeman.
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, there was in this non-disclosure order itself a rationale which, when tested in the adversarial proceeding, the government and the court said that was a mistake. That isn't justifiable.
I hear you. That was the risk of flight.
That's correct, right. Your Honor.
So you have cause for concern and you're here pushing us to not be satisfied with this kind of generalized, you know, one size fits all, rubber stamp authority for the government to make its own determinations that are then deemed sort of final in practice. And, you know, one of the things that the court says in Freeman is the censors may be overeager. And it notes that, in fact, when the Maryland court started to look at these determinations, they mostly reversed them. So that's the nature of your argument here, no?
That's correct, Your Honor. And there is, as we all know, The benefit of an adversarial presentation is the benefit of an adversarial presentation. We, for example, I don't believe there's any reason, I don't believe there's any indication that, for example, the government or the district court considered ex parte before, at the very beginning, before we were involved, the less restrictive alternatives that we have identified. It is the government's burden to negate those less restrictive alternatives, but having the benefit of Twitter's involvement allows the court the benefit of a wider perspective.
Of course. Now, here we have something we didn't have in Freeman, which is, you know, there are cases in which the government has a need for confidentiality, and it's going to come to us ex parte. And I think you're right that the adversary system has strengths that when it is adapted and less adversary are missing. We don't lightly hear things in a non-adversary process. But assuming that there is some valid subset of interests that the government might have that justify ex parte, there is something here that is substituting for the full civil adversary process in Freeman, right? It is the court reviewing and testing the nature of what the government is putting forward. And I take it it's not your position that is categorically inadequate under the First Amendment.
We are not taking the position that the statute, that 2705B is unconstitutional, which 2705B authorizes issuance of a non-disclosure order before there's been an adversarial proceeding. And we're not saying that the lack of a advance adversarial proceeding renders the statute unconstitutional. If you would have a situation where the party who is speech has been restricted couldn't then go to court to challenge the maintenance of that non-disclosure order, that would be unconstitutional. And it would not be a substitute. The fact that there's been an ex parte proceeding before a judicial officer, but the party whose speech is restricted has never had an opportunity to challenge the validity of that, yes, that would be unconstitutional. I also want to underline something that this case that we have before us is an incredibly unusual and peculiar case in many respects. It is incredibly unusual and peculiar because it is very rare for there to be investigations that are as public as this investigation. The Department of Justice's own—
Well, the district court cited the Mueller report and the Mueller investigation and very similar parallel type of situation. Similar orders were issued in that case. There was information in the public record, and there was still a need to preserve the integrity of the investigation.
And each of those non-disclosure orders, as the Department of Justice's own 2705B manual says, each of those non-disclosure orders has to be evaluated on its own terms. And it acknowledges that as—
Correct. I'm just saying, you're saying so unusual. And the district court disagreed and said, what about the whole Mueller investigation?
Well, the district court disagreed without, as far as we can tell, actually weighing our less restrictive alternative. The district court ignored—
You've moved on to a different issue. You're just saying this is so unusual. And I'm just telling you, why is it so unusual when we just had another special counsel investigation involving the same target?
Well, it's unusual because Twitter receives thousands of non-disclosure orders and warrants every year in run-of-the-mill investigations. And it is it is incredibly common for there to be an investigation that has not been announced by the Attorney General of the United States. There are tens of thousands of such investigations every year. It's incredibly common for there to be investigations where the closest confidants of the target of the investigation haven't been served at this stage of the investigation with subpoenas and warrants that are not accompanied by a non-disclosure order, and yet a non-disclosure order is being sought.
Do you know that that's true, though? There might be more that you don't know about that were served with non-disclosure orders.
That may well be. What I do know is that the daughter of the president, son-in-law, former vice president, his lawyers, all of his staff at Mar-a-Lago, his closest confidants, have been served with subpoenas and warrants without accompanying non-disclosure orders. And that is what makes this case unusual. And as the 2705B policy manual of the Department of Justice says, as an investigation, quote, becomes public, the ability to justify a non-disclosure order wanes. And so what we have here is a case, as the department itself recognizes, it has the kinds of features that make it harder to establish the need for a non-disclosure order. And that's what, so all I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the fact that this may well be a case, that if Twitter is correct, that is, as we assert, the non-disclosure order is not justified either on its by itself or in light of the less restrictive alternatives that are available, doesn't suggest that there aren't thousands of run-of-the-mill cases that weren't announced by the Attorney General at a press conference where it's totally appropriate to have a non-disclosure order.
Can we move on to the contempt?
Yeah, I'd like to ask about the sanction. The government argues in part that we should affirm the sanction imposed because even though there was this, you know, provision for a geometrically rising sanction, the compliance was you know, not weeks or months and billions of dollars later, but $350,000 later, and that itself was not an impermissibly severe or onerous amount. Now, I'm bracketing for the moment your argument that no sanction is warranted. And I hear you that you're making an argument that there were good faith and substantial efforts to comply. But assuming that there is a basis for some contempt sanction, I'm focusing on the reasonableness or not of the amount. First, are you separately challenging the reasonableness or not of the amount?
Yeah.
Do you think it's before us the formula, given that the amount was not stratospheric, you know, because the formula wasn't allowed to run for a longer period?
Yes, I think both the formula and the amount is before you.
Did you challenge the formula before the district court? Because I don't see that in the record.
Well, we challenged the application of the sanction before the district court,
but not the formula.
Well, I don't believe the government has argued that we've waived the challenges we've made in our appellate briefing. So even if it were the case, which I don't think it is, that there's been a waiver, there's been a waiver of the waiver by the government. I think before the court right now is our challenge to the reasonableness both of the total amount, the formula used, and to the defense of good faith substantial compliance. And on all of those grounds, we think the district court plainly abused discretion. I'm unaware.
But to nail this down, though, there is no record citation to where you objected to the formula. The district court, because I wasn't able to find that.
Your Honor, you're right. In the district court, the court turned to the government and said, "What do you propose?" And the government said, "Well, we haven't thought about it." And then the government counsel conferred at the table and said, "We'd like a $50,000 a day sanction that doubles on a daily basis." The court did not turn to Twitter and said, "Well, what do you think about that?" The court, and we said, "That's what I'm imposing." So that's the way that it proceeded. We believe we've.
But you're not shy. You could have interjected and said that seems excessive, or you could have filed something. And you did file something later, but you never objected to the formula.
I believe Your Honor has accurately described the record. It is also the case that we have challenged every aspect of the sanction in this court, and the government has not been shy about claiming that we've waived certain arguments. They have not argued that we have waived those arguments. So it would be, I think, extraordinary in the face of this unprecedented sanction to hold waiver against Twitter where the government itself has not.
But you didn't give the district court an opportunity to consider these arguments. I know you're saying they waived the waiver, but I think our point is you should give the district court an opportunity to address your claim that this is outrageous and exponential and unprecedented.
What we did argue to the district court when the district court was considering imposition of the sanction, we argued that the sanction was unreasonably severe. That's the submission that we made in the final submission to the district court.
But are you asking us to just declare that the fine or the sanction is unreasonable or to remand to the district court under some standard of some sort?
I think we are challenging, we've made a number of challenges to the sanction. One of the challenges we've made is that the sanction is, but the structure and total amount of the sanction were unreasonably severe and therefore had become punitive rather than coercive. And I think that is a ground that if the court agrees with us, would and should result in reversal without remand. We've also argued that the district court committed a series of legal errors in the course of considering our defense of good faith, substantial compliance. And we believe that there's no need to remand because the facts that would bear properly considered, the facts that would bear on that question are all undisputed and before this court. But if the court disagrees, that would be a ground that could be remanded to the district court to apply the test in the correct way. So I think there are a series of options that are available, I think, to the.
So Mr. Holzblatt, here's a question. The district judge had heard from you on the day that she imposed the contempt schedule that your client was prepared to fully comply with the warrant by that same evening. Correct?
Well, not quite, Your Honor. The citation is at JA210, is the exchange with the court, and the court asked, can you produce the warrant returns by 5 p.m.? And we said, I believe we're prepared to do that. Yes, Your Honor. And the reason I said not quite is because the word fully is not there in the record. And I think the exchange that counsel had with the court, I believe there's a context that needs to be considered, which is that we were in the midst of an ongoing dialogue with the government at the time, and that dialogue was reflected in the court's filings, where he had repeatedly said that we had preserved data from our standard toolings, that's at JA 814 and 51, and we're willing to produce data to be held by the court without review, that's at JA 42 and 46, but that there were, quote, technical issues we will need to work through in responding once this issue is resolved, that's at JA 55.
But doesn't that all imply—
But that doesn't change— Oh, go ahead.
I think we might be saying the same thing. Doesn't your response, though, imply that you're going to get all that taken care of by 5? Because the question is, can you produce the warrant returns by 5 p.m.? And the response is, I believe we are prepared to do that. Yes, Your Honor. Doesn't that imply full compliance? And if it was not going to be full, wouldn't it be incumbent upon Twitter to say so?
I think that the exchange with the court certainly could have been clearer, and I acknowledge that. But I do think the exchange was happening in the context that I just described. And in particular, what we had said to the government and in our submissions, which was in the declaration that was submitted to the court, is that technical issues will, future tense, need to be worked through in responding once, future tense, sorry, this issue is resolved. And so, and that was specifically saying to the government, we have stuff we need to sort out with you, and we need to work it out.
But that's the government, not the court. Here you have a court saying, can Twitter produce the warrant returns by 5 p.m. today? There's no caveat on, but of course, you're still working with the government on some dispute. Can Twitter produce the warrant returns by 5 p.m. today? I'm reading from JH10. I believe we are prepared to do that. Yes, Your Honor. The next page, she refers to a clear and unambiguous court order in place and requiring Twitter to comply with production of the specified records by January 27, 2023. And two pages later, the court says Twitter has no defense for its failure to comply with the search warrant. And you are not anywhere in this or your colleagues saying, well, we're going to give, you know, what we can. We've got some technical things. We've got some things we're working out with the government. So what I'm thinking about is what is the court on notice of when she imposes the sanction? And if I'm a court who thinks this is all going to be over today, I'm going to be less careful about whether 21 days out, the formula I'm imposing is going to lead to a $100 billion contempt sanction. You know, that's a very, and it's harder for me to see the coercive impact being particularly relevant in this case, where there's been an exchange and the court really thinks that you have heard her, that you're going to give it all over.
I understand what Your Honor is saying. And this was a fast moving proceeding. And I acknowledge that we could have been clearer in the district court, and I've tried to explain to the court the statements that Twitter was making happening in that context. However, I want to make one important point. In Washington Metropolitan, this court held that there is an obligation at the end, before actually imposing the sanction that had been announced at the beginning, to determine not only, quote, whether there is indeed a contempt, but also whether, if so, it be of such magnitude as to warrant retention in part or to any extent of the coercive fine originally provided for in contemplation of out-and-out refusal to obey. And so the court, this court in Washington Metropolitan, that's at 531 U.S. at 621, said the court, and the reason for that is because the purpose of the contempt sanction is purely coercive. It is not punitive. It is not, and the court said this in Washington Metropolitan as well, it is not to vindicate the authority of the court. The purpose of the contempt sanction, sole purpose, is to ensure that the party move as quickly as possible to actually bring itself into compliance with the orders of the court. And so the court, and it is a harsh tool. And it is a tool, as the court said in Washington Metropolitan, that is very risky of abuse. And in order to protect against all of those concerns, this court said the court must evaluate at the beginning, and it must evaluate at the end whether, even if it announced a schedule, it has to evaluate at the end whether it should go through with that schedule. And what the court—
But the schedule in this case just ended up with $350,000, which for your client is not an undue amount.
Well,
given,
I don't,
given just what I understand about the size of your client.
So I don't agree that it's not an undue amount. I'm not aware of contempt sanctions, anything like this. And we argued in our papers, this is unprecedented. The government didn't come back and say, here's the precedent that shows how reasonable this is. This is an extraordinary sanction.
But it has to be coercive. And your client is probably a lot bigger and better capitalized than a lot of the other people who have been subject to contempt sanctions. So it seems like if you're trying to coerce a deep-pocketed corporation like Twitter, it has to be a little painful or else you're not going to comply.
I don't agree. I don't think that Twitter—
And $50,000 is not that much to you, but $350,000 is a little bit more significant.
Well, I don't think that Twitter is more well-resourced than the United States government, the largest economy in the world, and the only example that—
Yeah, but it's not subject to an anti-deficiency act or all kinds of problems.
The only example that the government has pointed to of a doubling sanction was the Pigford sanction, which I'm sure the court's very familiar with, which was $1,000 a day that didn't double for a month. We've pointed to China, which is the largest economy, the second largest economy in the world. We've pointed to multi-billion-dollar banks.
Yeah, you didn't point these out to Judge Howard.
We did argue to the district court at the time that Washington Metropolitan says we should argue it, which is at the end, that it was unreasonably severe, and Judge Howell mechanically calculated the sanction without evaluating the complexities of compliance, which is what—
But you didn't raise those. You're saying she mechanically applied it, but you didn't raise these arguments you're raising to us, to her, so that she could evaluate that.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, we did. At the end of, before the court imposed the sanction, we said, here's what we have done to substantially apply in good faith.
I know, I'm just referring to the formula. You did not, you're telling us now that this formula is unreasonable, but you didn't say that to her. And now you're pointing to Pigford and all these things that she didn't have the benefit of knowing about because you didn't raise it.
What we said to the court was that the sanction is unreasonably severe. And the court at that time believed its obligation was simply to add up numbers, not actually assess whether or not, as this court said in Washington Metropolitan, whether at the end it was still appropriate to go through with the sanction that it announced at the beginning. And I believe actually the record is quite clear that the court viewed its job as simply adding up the numbers, not as evaluating after the fact whether it should still go through with the sanction it announced at the beginning.
All right. Any questions from my colleagues before we let Mr. Holzblatt?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
All right, thank you. And you have, we've taken you on a much longer course than we had scheduled, but we will still give you a brief amount of rebuttal.
I appreciate your honor, and I appreciate all of the court's time and attention to this difficult case. Thank you.
Mr. Pierce, good morning.
Good morning. Please, the court. James Pierce, United States. As the district court correctly concluded, the 180-day non-disclosure order furthered compelling interests, including safeguarding the integrity of an ongoing criminal investigation, and it was narrowly tailored. The district court reasonably adjudicated Twitter's non-compliance with the warrant for addressing its separate challenge to the NDO, and Twitter's procedural claim is both moot and meritless. Finally, the district court did not abuse its discretion when it held Twitter in contempt and imposed the $350,000 monetary sanction. Now, a lot of ground has been covered, and I think perhaps my time up here is most usefully spent trying to respond to the court's questions. So I'm happy to go through plenty of that I saw in notes, but I'm also happy simply just to respond. Where I had intended to start hearing my friend's argument on the other side is, I think, in exchange with you, Judge Pillar, which is, we agree that the analysis is, what was the district court look in terms of the adequacy of the NDO at the time that the court was making that consideration? In other words, the government can't go back and say, here's what we found, and that's now going to justify the factors under 2705B. Right?
But he's also making a separate argument, which is that you have an ongoing duty as you accumulate more information, and specifically the returns from the warrant, to reassess whether at that time the NDO could have been lifted. And I wonder whether you think that's accurate as a legal matter, and whether you are confident that in the continuing support for an NDO, given the returns that you now have.
So I don't think that's accurate, right? A court enters the NDO for the time that it believes is appropriate. And there's nothing to say that there's some sort of intervening check-in that happens up until that time. Certainly, when an NDO lapses, the government, if it chooses to seek renewal, needs to go back again and satisfy the district court anew that the factors or perhaps additional factors had come into play. As a practical matter, I can say, although Twitter had made its production, I believe, a week or so before the government filed its response to Twitter's motion to vacate, there are filter and review processes that meant that the government didn't actually have in its hands this information to go through and analyze and to sort of, even if this were an obligation, which again, I don't think it is, to supplement the record with, you know, based on what we found. And the point, again, is that it's an ex-ante determination.
And the government did not supplement the record with what it found.
Well, so I think we did in defending, so I think it's important to parse two different things, right? There's the 2705B factors, that is the process of securing a non-disclosure order. That is, you know, the universe of five statutory factors. The government relied on factors 3 to 5, notwithstanding essentially the Scrivener's error of including the risk of flight. When then Twitter comes in and makes its First Amendment challenge, that's a challenge that is broader than, in our view, than just the world of 2705B. Certainly the factors identified in 2705B, as the Third Circuit said in the recent In Re Matters, you know, all these cases have sort of names that make them hard to distinguish, but in the 2020 decision, said more or less the 2705B factors capture what will be a compelling government interest. And frankly, it's very hard to imagine a case in which the district court does a good faith analysis and comes back and finds 2705B satisfied. In other words, it's not simply a rubber stamp, as I heard the phrase before, and there then not to be a compelling government interest. That said, however, there's certainly nothing to say that, you know, to determine a compelling government interest needs to be coterminous with the five factors in 2705B. I mean, I think here, the factors upon which we rely, and we talk about this in the brief, we talk about this in terms of the ex parte record as well, I think are largely encompassed in the broader term, you know, safeguarding the integrity of the government investigation. That includes things like evidence spoliation, witness intimidation, and then the catch-all of jeopardizing the investigation as a whole. Now, again, I'm happy to entertain questions on the compelling government interest, but, you know, I think I've given a broad overview, and I can deal with some of those to the extent that it has more granular questions, perhaps in some sort of ex parte format.
Let me just ask you in terms of the compelling interest. You know, Twitter has consistently argued that much about this investigation is already public, and really questions, you know, from its admittedly non-omniscient perspective, how the marginal disclosure of this warrant could generate or increase the harms that the government has identified as the compelling interest for the non-disclosure order. Can you address that generally? And I would like in a brief ex parte session to hear more granularity, but just in general terms.
Speaking more generally, I would say obstructive nature of the former president's actions, you know, as evidence, the district court in its opinion below, historically speaking, identified with respect to the Mueller investigation, a number of actions that the former president had taken to try to obstruct aspects of that investigation. I think there is similar evidence here.
And in that, you're referring to paying attorney's fees for witnesses, offering pardons?
Sorry, Your Honor, that would be part of the ex parte session here. I'm talking what I was
historically, referring, though, wasn't that something that was?
So I don't know if that was part of the Mueller investigation, but it was various efforts to try to terminate the then special counsel Mueller, to try to intervene with then FBI Director Comey, asking the White House counsel to try to take some of these steps, these kinds of things to try to undermine the investigation. So the point here is just the broader point of this particular individual, the former president's demonstrated history of obstructive conduct. Again, in terms of more specifically how that reflects into this investigation, I'm happy to talk about separately. I do think, though, the fact that some of this information is out in the public, yes, it's true that makes this, less usual than a criminal investigation where there is sort of no or very little information. But that still doesn't change, as I think I heard Judge Pan saying, the nature that the government's compelling interest remains compelling, particularly, again, for the obstructive reasons that I mentioned.
In terms of less restrictive alternatives, what about Twitter's proposal that a associate or representative of the president could be informed and even indeed put within the confines of the non-disclosure obligation? And I heard today Mr. Holtzblatt say, even if that person weren't empowered to assert executive privilege without consulting with the president, it would be materially less obstructive or restrictive of Twitter's speech to allow that. Does the government have a position on that?
So as your question suggested, this is sort of the first time. It's been a bit of a moving picture as to precisely what the least restrictive alternative that Twitter proposes is. I think, however, there are some questions with it. So I disagree with my friend on the other side that we somehow conceded that the list of representatives are necessarily trustworthy, or that there's some that are trustworthy or some that are not. As one of the questions, I think it was your question, Judge Pillard, indicated, they're going through a kind of person by person analysis to determine who's trustworthy, who's not. As the Third Circuit again said in the subpoena case from 2020, it's a line drawing exercise that courts shouldn't have to spend time going down and undertaking their time to do. And I expect the response will be, well, this is the First Amendment and it's got to be the least, tailored alternative. But already we're talking about something that is not a film or a speech, to sort of emphasize the difference in context. This is a very narrow slice of speech. This is Twitter conveying information that it has received from the government. And I'm not discounting that they have a First Amendment interest in doing that. My point is simply that this is a narrower, it is a narrower quantum of interest, and it's also time limited, right?
They haven't made the argument in these terms, but just to really push you on this, for them, this is a hugely public moment, retrospectively becomes known. All of their subscribers are feeling pretty comfortable that their information is secure, and that if anybody wants to go behind that curtain and pursue some form of criminal investigation against them, they'll at least know about it. And for their, to the extent that speech matters to them as a business matter, it's a big deal.
So I couldn't disagree more with this notion that they will know about, not until as an empirical matter. I have no idea what the common Twitter user might think or not. But as Judge Carney said in the concurring opinion in the Microsoft case, the probable cause analysis is the protection that is there, right? It's not just like the government can go in and grab this stuff. It has to go before a neutral court, it has to go before a judge and prove that there is probable cause to undertake this search in the first place. And then on top of that, it has to be the additional step of saying, not only was there probable cause to go and get access to this information, there is the additional factors under 2705B that shows why it is that the, it can't be disclosed so that that user, you know, is not alerted to it with the potential consequences of jeopardizing the investigation. I have no
doubt. And then by doing so, would you suggest that any of these types of cases are more fact specific? Like we wouldn't be painting a broad brush in terms of how we would tailor any order. We would be looking at what has occurred here.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, obviously the court has to analyze the relevant kind of set of facts and its application to the laws, you know, to 2705B here. But I don't think there's anything here, right? I mean, if a user, if this is some picking up on Judge Pillard's sort of framing of this, if down the line someone were to find out, well, you know, the government got access to this Twitter account, you know, it would also be part of the discussion. It got the warrant. They went before a judge. They justified the 2705B, sort of kind of kicking in the Friedman question. There's been a lot of adversarial, perhaps not fully adversarial, but pretty adversarial process here, right? I mean, Twitter has filed its motion. We have responded. We've gone back and forth on this, and here we are before this court. What Twitter v. Garland said, and as I heard, I think my friend on the other side quote it, is, you know, long as these processes have sort of a robust process, that sort of stands in for the Friedman type concerns. You know, we obviously argue in our brief that Friedman in the non-criminal context has little, if no applicability here. But the point is there is plenty of process that enables the full airing of Twitter's First Amendment.
So I'd like to go back to your point about this being sort of a sliver of speech. It's like not the same type of speech that you see in other contexts, like a film or somebody who wants to speak in a public square, express their political views. And it seems that in other cases, the government has taken the position that intermediate scrutiny should apply, such as in the Third Circuit case and also in the Second Circuit case. You said something less than strict scrutiny could apply. And there is support for that notion in a lot of these cases, which talk about the value of speech about, for example, something you knew before the government process commenced, like in the grand jury, versus things that you learn only from the government. So there seems to be ample support for the notion that strict scrutiny shouldn't apply in this context where the speech right that's being asserted concerns information that Twitter has only because the government has given it to them and they want to disclose this information just about the government investigation, a very small bit of speech that, for example, the Second Circuit says this is different from restraints on things like those who customarily wish to exercise rights of free expression, speakers in public for it, distributors of literature, exhibitors of movies. It's a different kind of speech. Yet it appears that you're not asking for a lower standard of scrutiny. I'm wondering why that is.
So I agree that there is, you know, precisely sort of the line of discussion. I'm not aware of a court that has held that a something other than strict scrutiny. There have been plenty of courts, as the district court did below here, the Southern District of New York Court and Google, that say, look, I'm just going to assume without deciding that strict scrutiny applies. And I think we prevail even on that more exacting standard. But I'm not going to fight the premise we certainly have in our footnote. I mean, the district court recognized this below. Dogu v. Mukasey in the Second Circuit has said, perhaps that was precisely what you're quoting. You know, again, similar to the discussion with Friedman, you know, again, we are talking about a quantitatively or a qualitatively different type of speech. And I think that's picked up in like the Reinhardt case from the Supreme Court, Butterworth. Again, those same ideas that, again, we're not here to dispute that Twitter has a First Amendment interest. It is just not the type of interest that is at play in many of the cases that it cites. In fact, it's notable that I don't think it cites a single criminal case in terms of the First Amendment, right? It cites Brown and it cites, you know, Reed and cases that don't deal with this kind of working out of First Amendment interests, where on the other side of this, you have, you know, interests in secrecy in criminal investigation. And so, you know, again, a long way to say.
So is it just easier to assume strict scrutiny and apply it than to sort of create this new, I guess, category of speech that gets intermediate scrutiny? Is that why? Is it a strategic?
As a short answer, I would say yes. I think that we believe the district court was fully correct that we prevail even under strict scrutiny. I'm not aware of, in fact, a single district court or court of appeals that has held otherwise. I suppose with one exception, I can think of a central district of, or I think it's a central district of California, a district court case where the NDO had no time limitation at all. So it was indefinite and there that flunked. But barring something like that, I think it's telling that even applying the more exacting standards, you know, again, where courts, as here, don't just rubber stamp, by and large, that's going to satisfy the strict scrutiny.
You mentioned mootness. And I just wonder about capable repetition, yet evading review. It seems like this is the kind of issue that's going to be on a pretty short timeline, but I assume that the United States will continue to seek non-disclosure orders, and then increasingly they're going to involve electronic service providers. So given that this is a legal wrong that's likely to recur, why isn't that a reason that we could reach the issue? It's not moot.
So you know, one answer is the case specific that's unlikely to arise again here. I understand that this is as a doctrinal matter applies in a framework more broadly. I will say, however, in this court's decision in Washington Metro, the court recognized that the capable of a repetition yet evading review is not necessarily a reason to just get to the issue. But more directly speaking, if and when this arises again, and I don't disagree that there is a high likelihood that the government will seek a warrant from a service provider and seek an attendant non-disclosure order, it can be, it's not evading review, right? I mean, a service provider there can challenge it. You know, we think the district court was absolutely right in rejecting what we call the fellow travelers argument. But we also point out in a footnote that, you know, Twitter could, in theory, this is not a result we would have liked, but could in theory have said, we're not going to comply at all. We're willing to take on all of the sanctions, maybe gone back and asked, you know, for a difference of the sanctions, you know, either staying the accrual of the sanctions or for some sort of diminishment, and could review it and have it reviewed in that case. But, you know, in terms of mootness here, Twitter complied, obviously belatedly, by whatever it was, February 9th. And at that point, there is nothing that can be done to undo its production to the extent its production was important to informing the former president about an executive privilege issue. Now, I feel like I didn't actually answer your question fully about the alternative measures, because that gets back to, I think I understood Twitter to say today, it would have still been satisfactory to alert the representatives, even if they were under some sort of disclosure, non-disclosure obligation themselves. It seems wildly sort of different than how they began litigating this case, which is this is about trying to protect the potential executive privilege. And now today I hear, you know, this argument, well, even if they don't, even if the former president never hears about it, and there's never the possibility for any executive privilege claim, that would somehow still, you know, have us vindicate our First Amendment right. And that just, it really just makes me wonder what we're doing, quite frankly. I'm happy to turn to sanctions or address any other questions.
Yeah, on the sanctions amount, this is a, I mean, one wonders whether this was even what the district court intended, to have it double every day to the point where we're talking about, I think, hundreds of billions within 3 weeks. What's your position on whether that's reasonable or whether we don't have to so hold? Maybe reasonable, whether that's an abuse of discretion.
So it is. The question, as I understand it before the court, is was the sanction imposed reasonable? And a $350,000 sanction for a company of Twitter's valuation was reasonable. I mean, the point, obviously, of a sanction is to induce compliance, and that worked, right? I don't.
But clearly, if the district judge had said, all right, you've told me you're going to comply by today, and if you haven't complied by tomorrow, it'll be $350,000. And the next day, it'll be $100 billion. and they do comply by the next day. And so all they have to pay is $350,000. Is it really the case that we don't have to consider that threat that they were facing, that the very next day they would face an $100 billion sanction?
I mean, there's some hard hypos here, right? And you, at some point, I mean, you could say, you know, and I'm going to imprison you and toss you in a dungeon or something like this. And I do think, you know, at some of these far extremes, yes, I suppose it could get fairly troubling fairly quickly. But I think there are a couple of points in response here. One, the point I think I heard you articulate, which is, I think it would be one thing if the contendor was making noises to say, slap whatever you want on me, I'm not planning to comply, and nonetheless you get one of these kind of exponential things that's clearly going to blow through.
I think it's not exponential, I think it's geometric, but it's nonetheless steep.
There's a reason I'm a lawyer and not a mathematician. But right. The point just being, you know, under the circumstance where it's clear someone, you know, to avoid mootness, to go back to a colloquy we had a moment ago, and a court was going to, it says, doesn't matter. I'm going to hit you with something that's going to bankrupt you in 3 weeks, right? So that's kind of point one. I think the context here is quite relevant. Point two, in addition to Pickford, where you had the kind of going up $1,000 each month, you also have the case that my friends on the other side cited in their brief, City of Yonkers, that involved, I think it started at 100 and went up by day. That ultimately, what the Second Circuit did there, it modified it, and it basically said, it's fine doubling like that. That's an acceptable way to structure a fine. When it hits $1 million, though, or I mean, technically, day 14, it hit $800,000. Next day, it would have gone over $1 million. The Court of Appeals said, on sending it back, it's got to be $1 million a day thereafter, because otherwise we get into some pretty dicey territory. Now,
is there harmless error analysis that applies to this? Because what we have here is maybe the formula was erroneous, but since it didn't get that far, we're only at 350. Does harmless error apply here? And can you also apply the waive the waiver argument, because they didn't challenge this formula?
So I'll take those one at a time. The point I was trying to make the City of Yonkers is I don't think there is, in fact, error with that kind of a structuring. At a certain point, I think it could get problematic. Our bottom line here is $350,000 is well short of that point. If the court were to disagree and say, in fact, this kind of geometric structuring of fines was erroneous, it was nonetheless harmless for the same reason that $350,000 is reasonable for all the reasons. I won't go through the reasons again.
What about Twitter's substantial compliance argument?
If I can just finish answering Judge Pan's question and then turn
sure.
to that in terms of waiving the waiver. So I actually tend to agree that with my friend on the other side here, which is at least by saying that they did not, they opposed any fine, that they at least preserved their argument that they were challenging it. I agree that they could have done more to say, well, even if there is going to be a fine, you know, it shouldn't sort of look like the one that was ultimately imposed. But, you know, again, as I think I heard my friend on the other side, I think that sort of failure in clarity was similar to their failure in clarity when at JA 210, when asked, can you comply? And Judge Childs, I think this starts to address your question. They don't say, for example, you know what? We can give you everything that's in our standard tool or standard tooling, but there's still an area over which there's some disagreement. And we haven't been able to work that out yet with the government. So we can commit right now to be able to give you whatever we've already pulled, but we're going to need some additional time, and we'd ask the court to set, you know, one deadline for, you know, the 5 o'clock deadline on February 7th for what we've got readily available, and maybe give us, you know, they know better than I would, you know, 2 days, 24 hours to be able to figure out precisely what needs to happen next. I think that would have been certainly the kind of factual background that would have made a potential substantial, good faith substantial compliance argument, one that would have some teeth, but that's not what they did, right? I mean, what they did was say, certainly give every indication to the district court that Twitter was prepared to comply. And I would sort of add to that, you know, I think it's a bit of a mischaracterization of the record to suggest that Twitter was, coming forth and ready to negotiate, right? It made one comment, I believe, on February 1st saying,
you know, we might have some technical things that we need to work out. But if that's true, then continue to work them out. And by the way, right, to the extent the core concern here was some potential violation of executive privilege, that would have covered a minuscule amount of what was the production. That would have referred only to the direct messages from the former president's account. That would have had nothing to do with anything else in the entire production. And so easily Twitter could have been working towards having any negotiations about something that was, in their view, unclear about the warrant, resolving any technical issues that were required in making that production ready, but none of that apparently happened.
Mr. Pierce, your brief doesn't specify the precise basis of our jurisdiction. Is it 1291? Is it collateral order?
So, other than the piece that's moot, we agree that it's a collateral order, right? It's something that is doesn't go to the merits here. It's of substantial importance, and it isn't going to get resolved any other way. So on that point, we agree with issues 1 and 3 that collateral order.
And in terms of timing, I think the non-disclosure order is set to expire July 16th, is that correct?
It's either 16th or 17th. 16th is a Sunday, but yes, mid-July.
Okay. And so you're looking for an opinion, both parties are looking for an opinion before then. And do you have a view? I mean, we could talk about this ex parte, but do you have a view on whether we could issue a published opinion with redactions in this case, or would you assume the opinion should be under seal? I just have to be candid. This is my first sealed case.
So I think that it would probably be appropriate to issue it under seal and not publicly available, at least while an investigation is continuing. And I think it would be fair to revisit the question of its wider publicization, wider sort of publishing, whenever the investigation ends, in whatever way it does.
If the NDO expires on July 16th, why would the opinion need to remain under seal after that point?
That's a good point. I suppose I had in mind it would depend to some extent on what the opinion consisted of and whether there was information that would still need to be redacted. But yes, if the NDO expires and if the government doesn't move to renew it, I would think that any of the kind of discussion that doesn't implicate anything that's covered by Rule 60 probably could
so be. A redacted version perhaps could issue.
Yeah, that's right.
For the NDO expires.
If it were renewed, I think I would stand by the answer I gave a moment ago. But certainly, if it expired with no renewal, then I think that would be appropriate. If there are no further questions, I'd ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, Your Honors. I have just a few brief points to make. The first is I want to address the significance of the speech. It is the core of the First Amendment for someone to be able to speak about what the government is up to by their interactions with the government. That is especially true when what the government is up to may intrude upon the privileges or interests of individuals. One can imagine a circumstance.
What about the precedents that say this is different? Like, what's your response to them? You know, Butterworth and Reinhardt. And the statement in Doe versus McKasey, they say this.
What Butterworth says is the First Amendment isn't suspended with respect to a grand jury proceeding, which itself is a unique context.
Correct, because if it's information that you had before you went into the grand jury, it would be strange that once you go into the grand jury, now you can't talk about it. So there was a difference.
That's correct.
It depends on what you had before the government process began. But with respect to what Twitter has here, you had nothing until the government actually served you with the warrant. That's what you want to talk about.
Your Honor, that's true of every circumstance where people learn about what the government is up to comes from interacting with the government.
But then what about Reinhardt? Reinhardt says if you got this information just through discovery, it's not subject to the same protection because it's through the court process. How do you deal with these precedents?
Yeah, so let me address the Alsheimer's versus Reinhardt. The Alsheimer's versus Reinhardt dealt with an extremely different situation. In that case, the party, the reporter, had used the coercive powers of the court system to obtain private information. And that is a very different situation where a party has not actually used coercive powers of the state in order to obtain information from another party. When you have used the tools of civil discovery to obtain information that would otherwise not be available, it isn't surprising that it may come with a deal.
But isn't there kind of a loose analogy? You have the misfortune of being the target of the government's use of its powers because a subscriber, there's probable cause to believe that a subscriber has engaged in unlawful conduct. And so it's coming to you only because of the exigencies of some court process. And I know you challenge the exigencies, but for these purposes, assuming that there is a basis.
Well, I think I'm trying to make it what is, I think, a very simple, small point, Your Honor, which is that much of what we learn about what the government is up to comes because the government has interacted with us and has chosen to. It would be an extraordinary restriction of the First Amendment to say that when one learns about the possibility that the government's conduct is intruding on someone's rights, whether that's intruding on the relationship between a doctor and their patient or a journalist and their source.
I'm sorry, why is it extraordinary when I think there is ample precedent for saying that secrecy in criminal investigations is a well-established interest that the government has? Why is that extraordinary?
I don't believe there's any support for that secrecy alone is an interest the government has. There is an interest
all right,
in avoiding
secrecy to the extent that it prevents jeopardizing the investigation, which is what is asserted here. I just think that that's not extraordinary at all. I think that that's a long-standing interest, which is, I guess, demonstrated by Rule 6E.
We are not disputing that the government has certain compelling interests. What we are disputing is the suggestion that Twitter does not itself have an extraordinary interest here. We are not talking about a narrow slice of speech. We are talking about Twitter's ability to speak about something of extraordinary significance, which is what it has learned about the government's possible intrusion on important rights and privileges of its users because of its interaction with the government. Just as if a doctor received legal process that was seeking information about its relationship with a patient, or a journalist was seeking received legal process about its information, or Twitter received a legal process that was seeking information about a journalist, interaction with the sources, the ability to speak about what the government is up to is of the utmost significance. And I see I've gone over my time, but there was only one other point I was hoping to make, Your Honors, which is that we have from the very beginning, Twitter argued, my friend on the other side suggested there's been some kind of moving target. From the very beginning, Twitter argued that it should be permitted to disclose just to, as an alternative, just to representatives of the former president. That would not be an alternative if it didn't come with it some necessary restrictions so that representative would not be able to turn around and then communicate that to the former president. We believe that at a bare minimum, the availability of that less restrictive alternative means that this NDO does not satisfy the First Amendment.
I have just one question for you, Mr. Holtzblatt. Given that there will be at some point an opinion redacted or not if after the investigation is over, that will show that Twitter opposed this. Doesn't that, in some sense, assuage your concern about customer relations and, Twitter standing up for its customers, et cetera?
No, Your Honor. Two things I'd like to say about that. No, Your Honor, because speech is not just about being able to speak. It's about being able to speak when it matters most. That is the through line throughout the Supreme Court's First Amendment precedent, that the timing of speech matters. And even to this day, it still matters. We don't know the process. One of the concerns that we raised with respect to executive privilege that the user may want to assert is that the information that is covered by executive privilege may then be used in a grand jury proceeding, may be used with other witnesses which come outside.
No, I understand on the merits you think you'd like to speak sooner rather than later. To the extent that the interest that you're asserting as to why this is so important to Twitter is that you want to communicate with your customers and you want your customers to know that Twitter stands up for them, it just seems that an opinion that describes these proceedings at some point would address that concern that you have.
Well, Your Honor, we don't want our customers just to know we stand up for them. We want to stand up for them. And so our ability to speak now is what is the content of standing up for them. So it is important to be able to speak when that speech is most effective.
I do have just one more question, which is about the sanction. And I know this is not consistent with your position, and we have not conferenced and we have not decided the case, but if we were to decide that the sanction actually imposed is reasonable, but that the schedule is not, what relief?
Well, I don't think that those two can be fully separated. And I think so. I think that the fact schedule is not reasonable would bear on the sanction action imposed not being reasonable. I do also think that given the very specific facts of what it was doing over the course of the 51 hours for which it was sanctioned, if the court, as we believe it should, focuses just on the relevant period between 5 p.m. on February 7th and 51 hours later, there is no dispute that Twitter was acting in good faith and working as hard as it could throughout that period to comply.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. The court has no further questions. I believe my time has expired a long time ago.
I just wanted to say that as we ask counsel for Twitter to exit the courtroom and allow us to hear from the government, this is, you know, ex parte proceedings is not something that we do lightly. And yet it, I think, helps us honor the First Amendment interest that you assert to have an opportunity without having decided the legitimacy or not of their non-disclosure request to be able to probe that in more detail without others present. So I'm just explaining that, Your Honor, I
agree and believe that our First Amendment interest is best served by the kind of searching probing that Your Honor has described. So thank you.
Thank you. We'll take a pause to allow the courtroom to be